If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state, Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show, the second hour on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, we've got two brilliant guests. One is Magnus Stenlund, a Swedish geopolitical analyst and economist. And we'll be talking a little bit about whether Scandinavia will be the next front line in any conflict between NATO and Russia, with the news that the Swedes seem open to the possibility of hosting nuclear weapons on their soil. This has happened almost without discussion in Sweden. The Swedish media is still lying through their teeth. I saw the headline this morning and one of the main tabloids saying Putin is frightened to death and the Russian military is a technical museum or something like that. Even as Kirill Bonanov, the head of the Ukrainian military intelligence, is all over the wires saying that Ukraine is doing rather badly on the front line with the Russian advances north of Kharkov. Anyway, the Swedes are sort of sleepwalking into a closer conflict, of course, opening up a sort of at least a front of geopolitical tension on the Baltic is something that absolutely requires discussion. And we are devoted to sort of democracy and raising these issues. And Magnus is the person to talk to us about that. He'll be also talking about other Scandinavian news events. Finally, we've got Marianne Tupi as a final guest, who's got a kind of good news story. I mean, overpopulation is one of those things that doomsters often talk about. And the UN talks about the world population being up to about 11.6 billion. At the turn of the next century, although it's been revised downwards recently, some people have talked about a population collapse. We'll be discussing those things. But assuming that the population is going to continue to grow, well, he thinks he's written a book about it called Superabundance, that the more people, the better. We get more inventiveness, we have less scarcity, and we actually manage to find more resources on our space-limited planet. He'll explain exactly how he comes to those conclusions, and I'm really looking forward to that. Anyway, those are the two guests of this second hour. We've got Basil, of course, talking about news events. But I just want to say a little bit with reference to Catherine Engelbrecht, whom I had on the last hour, talking about how the Biden administration, there's this possibility that they're planning to use a kind of coup to either give the large number of illegal immigrants the vote as by executive order in October, and they will tilt the election currently favoring Trump towards Biden. Either that, or there'll be some sort of mischief and tricks involving mail-in ballots, which won't be checked for ID, which will allow migrants to vote and win the election. And it's going to be like 2020 all over again, with Biden actually becoming president come early January. So she's warning us to look out for that. But I saw an article this morning that talked about the large number of NGOs that are doing their very best to funnel migrants into the United States. And guess what? They're kind of linked to the Democrats, some of these people. They're called Global Refuge Southwest Key Programs and Endeavors Incorporated. Their organizations have seen their combined revenue grow from $597 million in 2019 to an astonishing $2 billion by 2022. These organizations, who do their best to take care of young kids, minors, allegedly, and then placing them out with sponsored all over the United States. And I guess these minors can then bring in their whole families. They're called anchor children, at least in Scandinavia. The CEOs of these nonprofits, which are changing the demographics and political future of the United States, are more than $500,000 each. That's you, the taxpayer, paying for that. Let's see. One of them is a former policy director for Michelle Obama when she was first lady, and she took the top job in Global Refuge in February 2019 after she lost her bid to be elected governor of Maryland. She's a kind of failed politician, and she appears frequently on MSNBC and other left-wing media pushing that migrationist message. This Free Press article, so much good journalism out there that you don't never see on CNN or MSNBC or CBS or New York Times. But anyway, there used to be DNA testing to ensure that these minors get placed in sponsoring families spread out across the United States. But apparently that DNA testing has been cancelled. So you can actually place these children or minors. Sometimes they're not minors, with people completely unrelated to them. So if the taxpayer believes that this is a case of poor children walking across the desert and then being reunited with their families, sort of a tear jerk of a story, that's not quite true. Most of the sponsors have no legal presence. Furthermore, most of the sponsors have no legal presence in the US. I don't know if I saw one US ID. There were no criminal investigators at the site, and there were no access to see if sponsors had committed crimes in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico. So these sponsors, that is, the people who take in these kids who've crossed into the United States, we don't know anything about their backgrounds. A lot of them are not US citizens themselves. So the very picture of this is well-funded, taxpayer-funded organizations, highly paid executives aligned with the Democrats, with offices near the borders, contributing to the demographic change, and absolutely on the side of the migrants and against perhaps the interests of the United States itself, and against the interests of the Republicans if they want to win the next election. Anyway, that's that little vignette. And the others, now, one more thing I just wanted to talk about before Basil comes on is, well, there's a lot of talk about who is really behind these protests at American universities, if it's a kind of, if they're sponsored by powerful foreign agents and so on. And they all seem, all these youngsters, all these young American students all seem to have the same tents, same design of tents. Is it a sort of Chinese operation to kind of mess up and mix up the American university world? Well, I just want to say there's something going on in a sort of what sounds like a color revolution to me going on in Georgia. I'm talking about the country, not the state, a country in Eastern Europe, which is seeing young people demonstrate against a foreign agent law. Now, I'll just give some background on this. A lot of the former Soviet republics have experienced what we call color revolutions. That is, groups of young people sitting for a long period out in the main squares of the capitals, and very nonviolent. A lot of their spokesmen, who are freely interviewed at the BBC, speak very good American English. They seem very, very determined to topple their government. The Western media do their bits. And there's often a U.S. embassy presence. Sometimes somebody comes in from the Western governments and talks to them, hands out cookies. Victoria Nuland famously did this in 2013-14, and that became the Maidan Revolution. And of course, that's changed world history. And even as the Americans and the British are losing on the front in Ukraine, well, small fires are being started elsewhere in the former Soviet Union countries. And my take on the whole Georgian situation is that this government, which is pro-EU and pro-NATO, doesn't want to go down the route of being destroyed. So it's playing it very, very softly. And it's instituted this foreign agent law that means that the NGOs that are backed by the West have to declare who they are. And it's a pushback against a foreign control of their country and these youth movements, which will pitch Georgia, hitherto a peaceful, successful semi-European country, if you like, into the next conflict in this proxy hot war between Russia and the West. They don't want to be part of it. They want to join the EU, but they want to do it slowly, slowly. They don't want to have to. And they see that these youngsters with their American accents, their nice teeth, their PhDs or whatever, sitting there and so naively and innocently demonstrating against the Kremlin-run government that's opposing them. Well, they see them as endangering the very careful tightrope that Georgia is having to march along. So I wish this government the best of luck. And I think that it's probably best for all concerned that this color revolution wind up. Anyway, we've got Basil on now. I think this is the Pelinero's Taylor Show. We'll be back after a very quick transition. Back.
Going 360 on the headlines.
It's really well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to our political editor, Basil Valentine. How are you doing, Basil?
Very well, thank you, Polly. Great to be with you again. And yes, it seems the Brits are the ones absolutely desperate to escalate matters with Russia, as we have been for well over 20 years now. The latest is MPs are being urged to change the law so that frozen Russian assets can help Ukraine. The Kremlin critic Bill Browder says American-style legislation would give the UK the power to confiscate money to support Ukrainian military efforts. Browder became a prominent campaigner after his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in custody in Russia in 2009. And today he's told the UK's Treasury Committee that passing laws similar to Washington's could change the whole nature of the war, well, it needs to, and help shift the burden from taxpayers to businesses and individuals subject to sanctions.
Well, that guy Browder, I mean, I had Lucy Komisar. Do go back into my archives, by the way. I've had some fantastic guests on this show. Lucy Komisar, I think she was on about two months ago. She exposed Browder as a complete, I don't know what I can say online, on air, but without being a libelous. But I mean, he was not what we think it is, a sort of hero of the truth at all, a dodgy character. But anyway, I don't see what, for a start, it's going to hammer the UK's and the US's credibility if they confiscate other countries' assets. And that's why they haven't done it so far, because it means that India and China and other countries are not going to want to park their assets in Europe or the US. So that's what I've heard, the reason why they haven't confiscated Russian assets. And the second thing is, it's not money that Ukraine needs, it's manpower. I mean, they're running out of fighting age men. So I don't know what Bill Browder's solution to that is.
Well, of course, that's the, you know, the nub of the matter, really, isn't it? It's once personnel from European countries or NATO start turning up, firing bullets at Russians, that we're in the World War III scenario. I don't know what else the Ukrainians plan. With plenty of money, there are plenty of people in the world willing to fight as mercenaries. Pelle, perhaps they'll go recruiting mercenaries from, you know, Africa or the developing world. That wouldn't necessarily surprise me. Meanwhile, GCHQ are getting in on the act. Keist Buckler, says her agency, GCHQ, is increasingly concerned about growing links between Russian intelligence services and proxy hacker groups who have long since taken advantage of a permissive environment within the country. Before, Russia simply created the right environments for these groups to operate, but now they're nurturing and inspiring these non-state cyber actors, she said in a speech to the Cyber UK conference, in what she's described as a globally pervasive threat. She's the first woman to be appointed chief of GCHQ, the UK government's listening centre. And she says that cyber criminals, typically from Russia, take control of a company's data and systems and demand significant sums to regain access.
Did you read that, more of that speech? Did she say anything about? I saw the headline and I thought, well, they're prepping up for a false flag attack, you know. But did she talk about the risk of the Russians threatening actual physical infrastructure? Because that's
She's also gone on about China, who I think she's more concerned about with respect to physical infrastructure. Apparently, these Russian groups are mostly interested in blackmailing, with ransoms often paid in Bitcoin and other virtual currencies like that. When it comes to China, she says that it poses a genuine and increasing cyber risk to the UK, and that the activities of Chinese hackers mean the country poses a significant risk to international norms and values. Beijing has apparently built an advanced set of cyber capabilities and is taking advantage of growing commercial ecosystem of hacking outfits to enter systems and steal data.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes wonder whether these
don't
things...
don't sound convinced, Pelle.
No, I do. I mean, I think, well, I'm sort of relieved if it's a call to war, and it doesn't sound like that. I mean, it sounds like the sort of thing that any newly appointed intelligence chief would have to say. I mean, these are bureaucracies, and they have to say, well, we need a large budget, so these things are threats.
That's right.
But if they were prepping for an escalation against the Russian successes on the ground, then I'd expect a different kind of language from her. That's all. That's so. I'm not surprised. I think that there is probably a cyber war going on both sides. Everyone, but as long as they play according to some rules of non-escalation, I mean, does it really matter? Or it's better than the alternative. That's what I'm saying. We mustn't fall into a physical World War III, and it's probably inevitable that these cyber conflicts take place.
Anything's better than that. Although some hotheads have said that we should regard cyber attacks as the equivalent of artillery shells. That's obviously completely idiotic. Meanwhile, on the war front itself, as well as making gains, Putin has now nominated top economic official Andrei Belousov as defense minister. And this is being interpreted by Kremlin watchers as a sign of the importance the Russian leader places on the war economy in gaining the upper hand in what he expects will still be a long conflict. According to analysts, it's unclear yet if outgoing Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu's move to head the National Security Council is a demotion or a promotion, while the future of its previous chief, Nikolai Patrushev, who is a shadowy but powerful figure and an ardent hawk, is also murky.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? We're back to the sort of criminology of the 1980s where people studied.
Yes.
I'm sure the Russians are lapping all this up, because I think one of the things is the Russians wanted to be taken seriously as a superpower. And now we're kind of nervously looking at their government shifts and reshuffles in a way we just wouldn't have done 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, I know by the names of a lot of their top leaders, and a lot of analysts, I guess, in Britain and the US do so as well. And that's... So they've fought their way to the top table, I think, and you can like that or not, but I think that's the kind of fact. I think we'll carry on. We're going to go off to our next guest. I'm going to talk to Magnus Stin and a little bit about what this portends for Sweden and Scandinavia, and whether the front line is going to move, whether even if it's not a cyber front line, the Swedes are big on cyber. Thanks a lot, Basil. We'll have more great analysis and banter tomorrow at 4 o'clock Swedish time, at 3 o'clock UK. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after the break.
TNT's James Freeman.
Nelson Mandela said to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The truth is, too many people have taken their eyes off the ball over the past 50 years. Too many good people have lived in the hope that electing members of parliament to take care of things for us every 5 years will keep things on the straight and narrow. The result of this is that we have allowed too much power to be concentrated in the hands of too few.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. The same way you plan each detail for those moments, start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff. Like making sure your kids are in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right at nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. The same way you plan each detail for those moments, start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make.
A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinero's Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, we've been talking about Ukraine, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the possibilities of this conflict escalating. We've got Magnus Stenlund with us. He's a brilliant geopolitical analyst and financial analyst. We're going to talk a little bit about the dangers of paper gold, I think he was talking about. I'll talk about that after the break. But first, he's got a channel called Svea Kanal. Unfortunately, it's in Swedish, but he offers some of the most astute and insightful commentary on Scandinavian affairs in a country which is totally overwhelmed by propaganda on the Ukrainian-Russian issue. Welcome to the show, Magnus.
Thank you.
This morning I saw going to the supermarket and a headline in the Expressen, which is Sweden's second largest tabloid, and every person who ever goes shopping for food in Sweden sees its headline. It's the most hottest piece of intellectual propaganda property in Sweden, as it were. And they say Putin's nightmare, and then talking about Putin's industrial museum, referring to his armed forces. Now, even the New York Times and the Reuters and everyone is reporting on the Russian advances now north of Kharkov. What do you think the Swedish awareness of the geopolitical situation is in Ukraine? And you had a fantastic interview with the Sweden Democrats' former defense spokesman, and he was talking about the inner shenanigans, inner games being played, which has ended up with a situation where Sweden might have nuclear weapons on its soil, which goes under the radar. We're not allowed to talk about those things. So can you talk a little bit about that, starting off with what is Swedish people's awareness of the true situation in Ukraine now?
It's astoundingly low, very, very low. Compared to what we expect from ourselves, we are even lower because we generally consider us to be well-informed. And in this topic, as you very accurately describe, the tabloids are way from where the reality actually is. But even the more serious papers are constantly referring to the same sort of analysis that they used to in, let's say, three, four months ago. It hasn't really changed that much. And what has happened meanwhile is that the Swedish defense minister wrote a very compromising agreement with the U.S., saying that the so-called DCA agreement, which says that Sweden allows them to establish themselves on our sovereign territory in 17 places. And even though there is some sort of understanding that we are not supposed to have nuclear weapons there in peacetime, we have no way of controlling this. We have no way of informing ourselves whether they do have brought nuclear weapons there or not. And that is also the assumption that we need to realize that the Russians, of course, need to assume that there actually might be nuclear weapons. And this morning, there was a published interview with the Prime Minister of Sweden, who actually also opens up for a possibility that Sweden will be allowing the Americans to bring nuclear weapons in times of war. And the interesting definition is, of course, times of war, because we have not defined that as something else than if we, since we joined NATO, we cannot really define this in any other way than NATO does. So I would say, or at least that's very difficult to do. If the NATO agrees on that there is a war going on, then we have an obligation more or less to also accept this. And we can end up in a very serious situation also because geographically, we have actually ended up in a totally different totally different situation than before we joined NATO. now NATO most forefront line of defense is actually in Northern Europe. And the funny or very strange thing is that we have a situation where most Swedes seem to be quite happy with this. And they have not acknowledged the fact that Article 5 in the NATO agreement actually doesn't bring us any mandatory help. If if things get worse, we will not be able to assume anything that else than that people in other nations may help us. They are not obliged to do that.
So Sweden could end up as a sort of cannon fodder. I mean, the next Ukraine, if you like, if the worst gets to the worst. I mean,
yes, and the even worse scenario is, of course, that we are now open to the possibility for a false flag operation, which I would say is how almost all major wars starts. Most people read the history books that are commonly available for us in schools. They don't even mention false flags except for, I think, Second World War. And that's because the Germans, of course, are supposed to be so much worse than anyone else. But in fact, most wars since Second World War have started in more or less the same way.
And we're going to go into a news break, because what we're seeing is the Ukraine thing is ending, basically, as far as I can see. But we've got the Danes saying, well, we may blockade the Öresund Sound and stop. We've got the color revolution in Georgia. We've got the Lithuanians always want to go to war. They might blockade Kaliningrad, which is just, you know, 200 or 300 kilometers from the south coast of Sweden. There are many potential flashpoints that the West might look to keep this war going and keep Russia on its toes. But we'll just we're going to pivot to another topic after a quick break. And you're going to talk about another development that's very high risk and that we ought to be told about. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got the brilliant Magnus Stenlund, who's got Svea Kanal, a Swedish channel, which you should go to if you speak any of the Scandinavian languages to find out what's really going on in that part of the world. We'll be back after a very quick news break on the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show.
TNT Radio News.
Get the news. The news.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. In the hush money trial of former President Donald Trump, ex-attorney Michael Cohen provided pivotal testimony detailing his role in handling sensitive matters, which are central to the prosecution's case. Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon has expressed concern about the United States' high level of deficit spending, as the cost of servicing the national debt has become a significant budgetary item, surpassing defense and Medicare expenditures.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Magnus Stenlund, who's a financial and geopolitical analyst. Magnus, you were saying that you've often analysed risk to people who are sort of less informed, and you'd like to highlight one of the things that we don't often realise, and which is that a lot of our assets, people's savings and pension funds and investment funds, are not actually backed up by anything more than trust. They're just pieces of paper. Is that the case? And what should we do about that? Because presumably it's like a house of cards; it could fall down at any time.
I'm talking specifically about what is commonly phrased as paper gold, which is actually not gold at all. But most people who buys gold will end up with this contractual arrangement, which says that, for instance, if you buy for an amount that is equivalent to 1 kilo gold, at one point in time, you will be you will get the same the equivalent amount that gold is worth when you sell it. But that's dependent on that the market maker actually is still around and wants to pay you and can pay you. And in fact, there is a huge volume of paper gold that is so big that I would say it's virtually impossible for the market makers, rather few very big banks, to pay us in case we would like to draw on this opportunity at the same time as a bank run, as you might say. And what has happened now this year is that gold price have increased quite significantly. And then after, let's say 2-3 weeks since back in time, you have had a more volatile up and down scenario, which indicates that the people are now trading to get their profit back, and they want to have they realize their profit. And that is probably the most dangerous moment that we can foresee, because that's when the banks has to pay up. And if I'm correct, the volume of paper gold is actually about maybe as much as 12 times the volume of actual physical gold. And that means that in value, it's actually even larger than the total value of stocks all around the world. It means that only property, real estate, is actually a larger type of asset in the world than paper gold. And that is virtually impossible for any one of the market makers to pay us. And it's even impossible for big government like the US to step in and cash them out. So
how could this situation have arisen? I mean, my sort of naive view, as somebody who's not schooled in economics or finance, is that gold was supposed to be, you take it to the bank, it's solid unlike everything else. But it sounds to me like sort of fractional reserve banking, which is when you banks lend out far more than they have collateral for. But yes, gold was supposed to be a solution to that. But now you're saying it's bluff like everything else. How could we get
most
here?
Of us we don't find it comfortable to buy gold because it's cumbersome. It's a lot of risk, of course. It can get stolen, and the transaction cost is high. So we buy an index product. It's a totally synthetic product. In most cases, not backed at all. You can't change it. So you can't release this paper to get actual gold. And that means that, in fact, I need to say why I think this market has become so large is because there is a huge demand for real gold. But since this paper gold is there instead, this demand is sort of spread out in a sea of paper that can always be reproduced in any amount very comfortably. And that has kept the gold price down, artificially down, much more than it should have been in case it would have reflected people's actual demand for gold in physical gold. And this is the whole point with the paper market, because if people had seen how much fiat currencies like the dollar and all other currencies in the Western world have shrunken compared to the gold standard, we would have this movement into gold would have been much more increased. It would have been a snowball and increasing very rapidly. But now it doesn't seem so good, even if it has increased much this year. It's not the best investment. If you take a few years back, you could earn more if you invest in stocks.
So, Magnus, if people presumably watching this show and who have their investment in paper gold, What indicators should they be looking at to see if there is a bank run and see if they should act quickly? What could they do now?
Very good question. The point is that you should call up these people who actually sell physical gold. And if they give you an indication that there is shortage of physical gold, that would be an alarm clock, because that says that probably physical gold and paper gold is no longer possible to price paper gold at the same price as physical gold, because central banks, they do not want paper gold. They only want physical gold, and that drives the price of physical gold. And if the paper gold is to follow, then these market makers will have a huge loss that they have to pay retail investors like you and I. It will be probably impossible for them to do so.
Mm. If we were to redesign, I sort of think everything's going to come to a crunch. I'm going to have a new world order, multipolar world order. How should we design our financial system? We've got to be quite quick about this, but it wouldn't be, because I always thought gold was the solution to, because it's, you can take it out, it's a universally accepted. But what do you think? I mean, this paper gold doesn't sound like a good idea. So where should we go in the future in the financial system? You've got about a minute to explain.
No, paper gold is fine as long as you keep track on the fact that it might suddenly be a crash. But physical gold is, of course, the hard-earned position where you end up. And you know that the BRICS countries, especially China, but also Russia, are buying physical gold. And I think that it will be the most probable way to at least assert some comfort when a crash comes.
Okay, so well, you heard it here first, Magnus Stenud, a brilliant financial expert. Love to have you on again soon. We're going to head off to our next guest, Marian Tupi, after a very quick break. Thanks a lot, Magnus. Have a good afternoon.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
In the mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you!
Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, overpopulation, well, that's a topic that a lot of people talk about as a sort of dystopian possibility. And I remember I was down in South Africa not so long ago doing a documentary, and everybody was talking about this gigantic, what they call a kind of atomic bomb of population growth that Africa's grown from 300 million to 1.5 billion since I was a child, and is set to grow to 4 billion by 2050. And we have these regular predictions about a world running out of resources, growing to 11 billion in the next century, at the same time as we have population decrease in many Western countries. But overall, population growth is one of those things you sometimes think about when just before you fall asleep. Well, Marianne Tupi has a good story for us, a good news story for us. He's the founder and editor of humanprogress.org and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity. He's written a book called Superabundance, which tells us that the more people, the better. Welcome to the show, Marianne.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess what you've got is a kind of good news story, which is that a larger population means more innovation. And well, what you found in your book is actually you present a lot of counterintuitive statistics, which are actually a cause for optimism and rejoicing. Isn't that so? Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. Thank you very much. Basically, people just need to keep one statistic in mind. In 1800, there was 1 billion people in the world. Today, there is 8 billion people in the world. But our standards of living are incredibly high compared to what it was 200 years ago. We live longer lives. Life expectancy rose from about 30 years to 76 years. We are better fed than people before. Obesity is now a problem, whereas before it was famines. We are much better educated, with something like over 80% of the planet now being able to read and write, whereas in 1800 it was maybe 10%. So across the spectrum, life is just much better, and it coincides with the tremendous increase in population growth. And what we are arguing is that the more people there are, the better life gets, simply because more people have more new ideas, which they then transform into inventions and innovations, which then improve standards of living.
Are you sure it's a cause and effect, though? I mean, is it the larger population which is causing our greater wealth, or is it incidental? Or let's say if we removed 4 billion people from the planet, let's say the least productive 4 billion, wouldn't the world be better?
Well, there is plenty of academic literature on this. There's Nobel Prize winning economist called Kramer, who has had papers on this going back to the 1980s. More recently, Charles Jones out in California are looking into causes and effects. But of course, I believe that there is a causal link. For example, if you have a very small community, let's say 100 people, maybe five of them are fishermen, and they go out into the sea and they get shipwrecked and they die, the knowledge that they possess about how to fish is going to die with them, and there is nobody who is going to be able to replicate that. Obviously, the more people you have, the more you can specialize, the more you can spread this knowledge, and you have more people contending with those ideas and building upon them. If you have a large population, that basically means that you can have more people devoted to things like, for example, looking for cures for cancer, developing new technologies to prevent global warming. So the more people, the better, because the more people, the more minds you have to basically address the problems that we have.
Although I ought to have come into this with the paper names of papers, but there's also scientists talking about the rate of innovation has actually slowed since the 1960s. So, and some people connect it to, I don't know, we're living in a, what's the word, dysgenic world, where more low IQ people are being born. And perhaps because we have better vaccines, and so there's a barrier. I mean, more not so clever people are surviving, and more not so strong people are surviving. Whereas in the late 18th century, 19th century, we're actually more intelligent today. And then we had wars, and although wars are terrible, I'm very anti-war, it did actually create innovation. So we had the computer and everything, but what we haven't done so much in the last 50 years as we think we've done. And that's because we live in a large population world with not so many constraints on us. What do you say to that?
Globally, IQs continue to increase. If you think about IQ as a ceiling, your potential of reaching, then obviously a world which is better fed and a world with better medical care means that a lot of children who in the past would have been, who would have never reached their intelligence potential, will now be able to reach it. That is the reason why globally, as our nutrition and healthcare improves, IQ scores are rising. Now, there is some evidence that IQ scores may be plateauing or even decreasing in Western countries, because obviously our healthcare and our nutrition have already reached their maximum potential, or maybe close to maximum potential. And what that really means is that, and that combined with the fact that smart people having children later on in life and fewer children that that could have this genic effect in Western nations, where whether you achieve your IQ potential or not is really dependent on your intelligent potential rather than the environmental causes.
Okay. One interesting thing, one of those counterintuitive things, you said that although the we got one planet, so there is a finite amount of resources, but, and I guess the Green Movement's been very strong in this, and they made an alliance with the sort of dystopian conservatives who think we're all going to hell. But you make the point that we although the population has grown, we're actually discovering more resources every year. Talk us through that finding, because it's actually very interesting.
Well, perfect example of that would be oil and gas. We've been using fossil fuels for over 100 years, and yet today we have more known reserves of oil and gas than ever before globally. What happens, obviously, is that when prices rise, people have more of an incentive to look for new deposits. We have only scratched the surface on the planet. We have no idea what lies deep inside. What we do know is that when there is an incentive for people to make a profit, they will go out and they will search for new deposits. There's also a lot of efficiencies, both absolutely and relatively. We use less tin or less aluminum in order to produce Coke cans. There is substitution going on. We no longer slaughter whales in order to get in order to get lighting. Now we use electricity. Right now, what I'm trying to say is that the planet is finite in a sense that we have only so many atoms on the planet, which we have had for eons, and those can, of course, be repurposed to achieve other goals. And more importantly, by the time that we are about to run out of anything, thousands of years from now, will be a spacefaring civilization that's able to mine the asteroid belt, for example, for additional minerals and metals and water and whatever else. Right now, we have everything we need. And more importantly, everything is getting cheaper relative to income. So the prices tell us that there is plenty on the planet.
Well, it's certainly interesting because I think Elon Musk has been talking about, he's very well connected to the latest in thinking. And he's saying that the alarm is rather that the West, at least, is seeing a reduced population. And that's logically consistent with what you're saying, basically, that we should have a greater population the thing is, your studies could be right, and they challenge my prejudices. And one prejudice is that the population of England, where I used to live most of my life, has gone up. I don't know, it's 60 million now, maybe 45 million when I was a child. And the quality of life feels just worse, you know. And now I'm in Sweden, which is Europe's last wilderness, if you like, and quality of life feels much better. And then I've traveled a lot in the third world, and you'll have to do a lot of convincing to me when I look at these sea of tin shacks, you know, and I see that the population of Nigeria has gone up to 200 million without any noticeable they haven't produced many nuclear scientists yet, you know. And I've seen people living on rubbish mountains in the Philippines and having high birth rates, you know. How does I can't see somehow I'm going to have to, I believe that all theories are interesting, but I'm having to combine that dystopian thought with your idea that more people always means better. Don't know what to say, really. I mean, are people skeptical to what you're telling them? I mean, it's interesting, and I'm not dismissing it at all, but a lot of people might be thinking along my lines that overpopulation is bad.
My ideas are not controversial within the economics discipline. I think that economists agree with us. I think that the public opinion is about 20 or 30 years behind behind reality, I would say. Reality being that rates of birth rates are falling across the world. They are falling even in Africa. Mm-hmm. Africa right now is the only continent I'm aware of that still has birth rates above replacement rate of 2.1. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Africa continues to grow population wise, but the world itself will reach maximum population in about 2065 or so, and then it will start declining. So we have to be aware of what will happen to the world when in 40 years time the world population starts declining. We have fewer researchers, we have fewer people to come up with new ideas and so forth. Now, with regard to Nigeria and Philippines and many other places, what I would say is this: our book does not mean to say that there are no problems in the world or poverty. What we are saying is that there are no natural limits to being able to take care of everyone, producing much more food. Of course, every year almost now, we produce produce more food than the year before. And that's because of tremendous gains in the agricultural sector. The point of the book is that there are no natural limits to what we can produce on the planet. Whether those gains are distributed properly is not a question so much of the natural ability of the plant to produce, but by political system that may or may not respond in a positive way. Obviously, Nigeria is a deeply dysfunctional country with very little property rights, with iffy political system. And so the country cannot produce as much growth as would be needed in order to take care of its own population and increase standards of living there. With regard to Britain, one of the big problems in Britain, as you are well aware, is the issue of housing. But housing is not really, if Britain wanted to, it could, of course, build more housing. There is plenty of space, brownfields, very famously, which are not being redeveloped into high rises, for example, that could house a lot of people. There is simply an aversion to building, both political aversion political aversion. When it comes to some of the largest countries in the world, Russia, the United States, and Canada, we are mostly empty.
It's true. I think, and of course, one of the richest countries in the world is Singapore, which has one of the world's highest densities. Although,
say Hong Kong,
yeah, indeed. So, is your advice then that we should introduce more pro-natalist policies in Europe, where we are seeing? Interestingly, I just want to say before I hand it over to you, India has got a population growth of 2. I mean, they've got 2 children per mother, and that's extraordinary. That's a stable population and sinking, or even sinking slightly. And that's a big takeaway I got from studying India very recently. So, Marion, you've got 2 minutes left. Tell us a little bit about natalist policies that we should be pursuing then. What's the ideal future, according to you, that we should be doing to continue economic growth and happiness and prosperity?
I would say remove obstacles from people having larger families if they choose to. I certainly would never endorse policies which force women to have more children than they want to. I believe that freedom is incredibly important. So parents should have as many children as they want. But there is substantial evidence that in the West, parents would want more children if government policies didn't stand in their ways. One of the most important way in which we could generate more population growth in the West would be to allow for better housing policies and more housing development. That seems to be one of the most important reasons for why young people do not form new households early and have more children.
Yes, yeah, so certainly it's a big problem. I mean, you talk about Generation Z. I had a guest on yesterday talking about the difficulty of getting on the housing ladder, staying with your parents too long, unable to start families, you play video games all day long, you don't have these rituals of parenthood and adulthood. Thanks a lot, Marianne Tupi. A brilliant contrarian view there. And I advise you to check out Superabundance on the internet or humanprogress.org and the Cato Institute Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity for something that is certainly provoking and challenging and very interesting. And you could well be right. Thank you very much to Baron Tupi. We are done for today, this Tuesday afternoon on the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show, and we will be back as usual tomorrow at 4 o'clock European time, 3 o'clock UK time. Thank you very much. Talk to you tomorrow.